All right. We are dealing with Joseph. Most of you know that, but we're just getting started and looking at him being sold into Egypt. And so get that up there on the screen. And we left off, I think, about verse 25 or so. If you weren't here, we were looking at the just really the terrible character of his brothers. And I don't know that any place in the overall narrative emphasizes that more than just right here. You remember, I think we were making the point towards the end of the class, verse 25, then they sat down to eat. And then it goes on, and them looking up and seeing the caravan. But just the picture of these brothers just sitting down eating when they actually are hearing the cries of their brother. And if you recall, I think it's in chapter 42, about verse 21 or so, about 20 years later, we find that the brothers are now in a predicament there. They've gone to Egypt to get some food, get some grain or whatever, so they don't starve to death. And they don't know, of course, Joseph is there and he's in charge, and they don't recognize him. And so he puts them through a few things. We'll get to that towards the end. But they're being held for, I think, 3 days or so. He's making them stay there and letting them decide. He's told them, If you want to prove that you're not spies, I want you to go back, send one of you back home and get your brother and bring him. And that was just a terrible situation. They didn't want to do that at all, but they really didn't have much choice. So they're in this predicament, and as they're sort of feeling sorry for themselves, their conclusion is all of this is happening to us because of what we did to Joseph all those years ago. And as they were talking about that, they mentioned the fact how they just stood by as they were listening to his cries. And so that's sort of information that we don't have right here in chapter 37. But when you read here in verse 25, they just sat down to eat. And you realize that they're listening to their brother begging for mercy, pleading with them to change their mind and let him free. And they're just eating. And if anything demonstrated the cold-heartedness of the brothers of Joseph, That would be it. It's just really a terrible situation. And you remember going back just a little bit about verse 18 or so, it says, and when they saw him from afar, or they saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. So this really wasn't any new thing, no doubt. They wanted to get rid of him. And that was probably something that was in their mind for a long time. And so they see him at a distance, and no doubt they could see his shiny coat coming. And they right away, they hey, this is our chance. We're going to get rid of this dreamer. And so they're just, they have murderous thoughts and, of course, a murderous heart then. And so they conspire to do this. But if you notice, it says at verse at the rest of verse 25, it says, and they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum and balm and myrrh, and on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Now, it's just amazing that everything that happens basically in the story of Joseph from this time forward really is providential in nature. Like, it's just amazing. Everything had to work out just right for the story to end up the way it did. Even to the detail of this caravan having to come by at this particular time. And it was a road that wasn't altogether, it wasn't unusual for a caravan to go that way and head to Egypt. But it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like you're driving the 77 or so and there's cars everywhere. I mean, it had to happen. The timing had to be just right. And so they look up and here comes this caravan. And that gives them, of course, an opportunity to do something. They're still not really decided what they're going to do with Joseph. And so if you look at the very next verse, verse 26 says, and then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? So clearly that's still on the table. Or else why would Judah even mention that? So, you know, Reuben, you know, he has the idea in the first place. We don't want to kill him. Let's just put him in the pit. But what are they going to do with him? So they basically have two options. They're either going to kill him or they're just going to leave him there. Either way, he ends up dead. They're just going to leave him there, but at least they don't have to actually do it. And so, but killing him, just really shedding his blood, is something they're still considering. They haven't decided yet exactly how they're going to handle this situation. Just leaving him there in the pit, and you know, if they just get their flock and go home, just leave Joseph there, he's going to die. But there's always a chance that somebody would come by and rescue him or something of that nature. And so that would kind of be a risky situation to go that route. And so clearly they're still undecided exactly what they're going to do. But again, by the words of Judah here, that killing him is something that they're strongly considering. And so, but when they see this caravan, well, that gives them another option. And so Judah then said again, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. And let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. Now, what does that tell you? No, let's not kill him. He's our brother. He's our own flesh. What does that tell you? They understand. He realizes that would be a terrible thing to do. To murder our own flesh. He recognizes there's a certain way, a certain line you shouldn't cross when it comes down to anybody really, but particularly family. He's our own flesh. Let's not kill him. But when you stop and you think about someone whose hearts are so cold and so full of sin, their reasoning is so off. Like, okay, he's our own flesh. Killing him, that would just, we really shouldn't do that. But throwing him in a pit or selling him to a bunch of Ishmaelites, well, that's okay. It doesn't matter if he's our own flesh. We can do that. And you know, there'll be some profit. So why kill him when we can sell him and even gain something from it? And so, you know, there's just the thinking of his brothers. So it says, come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites down at, it says the brothers listened to him. So they all thought that was a good idea. The Midianite traders passed by and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. And so he was sold. And really, you just, again, you just can't help but think about the providence of God. Because what's happening right now is the thing, is the really the first step towards preserving the people of God, the people through whom the Messiah would come. And so all of this is very, very critical. Of course, only God can see that. Nobody would guess that what was happening right now was so significant and important. And Joseph certainly doesn't understand what's going on, and the brothers don't. You know, sometimes God can use individuals doing wicked things to fulfill his overall plan. That is clearly the case here with this situation. But they sell him. And now, really, again, this was the best case scenario. It could not have worked out from a physical standpoint. It could not have worked out any better for these brothers. And one of the things that we learn, though, just because plans work out. You know, some people think that if plans work out, it must have been good, must have been a good idea, and that's not really the case. There's some people who live by that philosophy. That, you know, as long they determine what's right and wrong just simply by how things end. If things work out well in the end, well, whatever they did, whatever was being done, it must have, it's a good thing. And that one thing we should know, you can get away with a lot of things. Just because things actually work out in your favor doesn't make it a good thing. This was a terrible thing, but it couldn't have worked out any better. They don't have to kill them. They get a little money for it, and it's all set up nicely. Of course, Reuben, now, Reuben's not involved in this. We don't know what, you know, where he is or whatever, but it's clear that he's not with them. So we're not told about him. The only thing we're told then at verse 29, it says, when Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, the boy is gone, and I, where shall I go? And so why is Reuben so worried about it? Because he's the oldest. Exactly right. He bears the responsibility, really. And he recognizes that. So we get some insight as to why he wanted to do this thing and rescue Joseph. I like to say it was because of the goodness of his heart, but that wasn't the case at all. And it sounds like it was, there was a little self-preservation going on here. He knew this was a bad idea, and at the end of the day, he is the one that was going to have to answer for it, being the oldest. And then some bring out, some commentaries point out that, and perhaps, you know, there's the chance that he didn't want to disappoint his father again. When did he disappoint his father last? What did he do? Right, right. Slept with his concubine. And so we're not told the details of it. Kind of seems as if Jacob ignored that, but we don't have the details of that. We don't know what went on, what conversations they had. Clearly, Jacob was disappointed at him, and some believe he didn't want to bring that disappointment upon himself, that there was some real compassion here that he was demonstrating and wanting to rescue his brother, but all that plan failed. And so what we really have with Reuben is a classic case of too little, too late. And, you know, his plan was too little because, you know, what Joseph really needed is not the oldest brother trying to secretly arrange to rescue him. He needed his oldest brother to step up and say, listen, this is crazy. We're not going to do this. But instead, Judah just wanted, you know, well, I'll just come back later and get him. Well, again, by the time he does that, it didn't work out. Who knew a caravan was going to come by, and the other brothers were going to sell him into Egypt? But that's exactly what happens. But now he's kind of in a dilemma here of what he's going to do. But the other brothers have sort of worked out this situation. It says, and then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, this we have found. Please identify whether it's your son's robe or not. And he identified it and said, it is my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces. And then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, no, I shall go down to Sheol to my son, mourning. Thus his father wept for him. And so, you know, you stop and think about it. Jacob had a lot of heartbreak in his life, didn't he? I've been kind of hard on Jacob. And he, listen, he has shown himself not to be the greatest father of all. You know, he probably wouldn't win any Father of the Year awards or anything like that. But he was a patriarch, and he did some good things, and you always have to balance with these characters in the Bible, the good and the bad. But he went through some things. Like, he has lost his parents, We all, you know, some of us know, I've lost both of my parents. We know what that is like, regardless of the situation. And, you know, he's lost his parents. Who else did he lose? His favorite wife. In childbirth. Like, there's very few things in life that can be more emotional than to lose your wife in childbirth. Can you imagine the roller coaster of feelings and emotions that would be involved in that? It would be devastating. And Jacob has gone through that. Really, all he had. But now, he loses his favorite son. The one that he's shown all this favoritism to, that has really caused all kind of problems. Now he gets the news. He's been killed, probably torn asunder by beast. That would, I mean, it's one thing to lose a child, another thing to lose a child in such a way where, you know, you have this vivid picture in your mind of him suffering terribly at the hand of wild beasts tearing him apart. And so he mourns, and his children tries to comfort him, but he won't be comforted. And you can understand why. What a terrible situation. A lot of heartbreak in Jacob's life. Yeah, go ahead, man. Yeah. Sure. Right. I mean, no doubt. That's probably true with all of us. You know, most of the things, I mean, now, again, we could go through. I wasn't going to make Jacob one of the characters to go over. There wouldn't be anything wrong with that. His life is fascinating. Maybe we should have. But he did have a lot of faults. There's no question about that. But all of us, a lot of the problems that we have in life, a lot of it is self-induced sometimes. And just mistake. We're all human. We all make mistakes. And he certainly did. But, you know, we still feel for him. And I mean, some of the most devastating things that happened to him really wasn't caused by that. Some of his problems were his household and the friction and the hostility in his household. He had a lot. He could be blamed a lot for that. But he didn't have anything to do with his father, his wife dying in childbirth. And, of course, his parents passing away, that was just life. That just happens. But it's still loss. And now this thing with his son, does he share some blame and what has happened with Joseph? Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, again, it all goes back to that favoritism. That's why the brothers hate him in the first place. But nevertheless, you can't help but to feel for him. Now, something interesting here that he says, no, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning. And that tells us right away that Jacob had some idea of what happens after death. And so he certainly didn't think that, and Jehovah Witnesses have a fit with this, really. Because When it comes down to hell, what does anybody know their position on hell? What do they think hell is? Right. They don't believe in an eternal damnation. But, you know, they can't take all the passages out of the Bible that speak of hell. So what do they say it is? What is hell? Huh? It could be, huh? No, they think, yeah, go ahead. Right, right, yeah, but they think you cease to exist. But they think hell, in their doctrine, hell is the common grave. That's what they think. That's how they, and all the passages that talk about Sheol, to them, that's just talking about the common grave. And then they have to bolster that in the King James. A lot of times the word Sheol is translated grave. And so, you know, they have passages that they can turn to. But that's what they think hell is. That's the only, all of you are pretty much right in what you're saying. They think you cease to exist when you die. And the only hell there's going to be is you being put in the tomb, you being put in the grave. Well, that's a problem with this passage. Because when Jacob says, I'm going to go to my son in Sheol, does anyone here think he was saying, I'm going to go to his grave? I mean, no. I mean, obviously, that's a problem. Sheol certainly doesn't mean that. Here, let me just for a few minutes here, look at what Vine's Expository Dictionary has to say about Sheol. Because, interesting, he deals with this both in two different times. Here he's dealing with Sheol, but he also, in his dictionary, deals with Hades. And they, of course, are referring basically to the same thing. So the 66 occurrences of this word are distributed throughout every period of biblical Hebrew. First, the word means the state of death. And you know, things in the Old Testament, even in the New, things like death can get complicated sometimes, how it's used. There are certain things, particularly in the Old Testament, there are passages that talk about the fact that the dead know nothing, you know, things like that. But that is only dealing with things under the sun, as Solomon would often say in Ecclesiastes and his writings, that just from an earthly standpoint, the dead don't know anything from an earthly standpoint. Their situation has changed. Those passages are just dealing with it from a physical standpoint. They're not teaching that we cease to exist. And the word Sheol isn't used like that. He goes on to say Sheol is parallel to Hebrew words for pit, hell, corruption, decay, and destruction. Second, Sheol is used as a place of conscious existence after death. In the first biblical appearance of the word, Jacob said that he would go down into the grave until my son mourning. All men go to Sheol, a place and state of consciousness after death. The wicked receive punishment there. Those passages are interesting. They are put to shame and silenced in Sheol. Jesus alluded to Isaiah's use of Sheol in Isaiah 14 in pronouncing judgment on Capernaum, translating Sheol as Hades or hell, meaning the place of conscious existence in judgment. It is an undesirable place for the wicked, a refuge for the righteous. Thus, Sheol is also a place of reward for the righteous. Jesus' teaching in Luke 16 seems to reflect accurately the Old Testament concept of Sheol. It is a place of conscious existence after death. That's like the fourth time he said that, right? One side of which is occupied by the suffering, unrighteous dead, separated by a great chasm. From the other side, peopled by the righteous dead, enjoying their reward. And so Vines, again, he's just a denominational fella. He gets some things wrong, but he's absolutely right on this. Most of these expositors, these individuals, again, sometimes in their writings, they have a denominational flavor to them, but not when they stick to what they're good at. Like, they're expert at words. When they start talking, when they start in their teaching and trying to describe things, they start talking about doctrine and things, then whatever denomination they're a part of, that comes out. But when they're just dealing with words, which they're experts at, they're real good. So he was absolutely right. Now, later, this, he's actually dealing with the word Hades here. So with Hades, he says it corresponds to Sheol in the Old Testament. In the AV of the Old Testament and New Testament, it has been unhappily rendered hell. It like in the New Testament, you sometimes have in the King James Version, you have hell instead of Hades. And that's confusing. There's one place, I'm trying to think of where it is. It may be Acts 2. Even the ESV, inexplicably, I don't know why the ESV, you know, the ESV is more modern and understands the translation. But even they, in one place, I can't remember. I don't know if anyone here remembers where that is, but they translate the word Hades, hell, in one place that like lost their mind or something. But he points out it's unhappily rendered hell in Psalm 16:10 or grave or the pit. In the New Testament, writers have always used the rendering Hades in the Old Testament. They have not been uniform in the translation. Example in Isaiah 14:15, hell, the margin is Sheol. Usually they have Sheol in the text, and grave in the margin. But here's what I like, what he says. It never denotes the grave, nor is it the permanent region of the lost, a point in time. It is for such intermediate between deceased and the doom of Gehenna for the condition. See Luke 16. We're all familiar with that. So that's very interesting. Again, guys like Vines, they're pretty expert on words. And he says that the word Sheol never refers to the grave. That obliterates the Jehovah Witnesses doctrine. And so it's not referring to eternal damnation, Gehenna, that's the lake of fire. But it is, Hades then, really, Hades is the place of departed spirits. The place, the unseen realm of the dead. That's Hades and Sheol. And that makes sense in what we're reading in Genesis. That's what Jacob thought, obviously. Where did he think Joseph, now that he's been torn apart by a wild beast, where do you think he thought he was? In a grave somewhere? No, he was in the place of departed spirits, the unseen realm of the dead. And Jacob now, he's looking forward. He wants to join him. He's looking forward to being with him there. And so very interesting. We have an Old Testament passage here like this that goes a long way in helping us understand life after death and what happens to us. And then the chapter closes here. Verse 36 just says, meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. And that just kind of sets the stage for chapter 39 and Joseph being sold into Egypt. All right, any questions about that, about chapter 37? It's really just getting started, but all of this was very significant to get the story where it needed to be. And so Joseph now, his life is great and wonderful. He's the favorite son of his father. He seems to have a pretty good, even easy life. But that changed very quickly. And so now he's sold into Egypt. All right, no questions about that? So, Joseph alone in Egypt. And it's just quite remarkable, again, how quickly life can change. And this is kind of typical. Like, we can learn from this. Because it happens to people all the time, and no doubt it has happened even to you. And maybe not to the extent of what happened to Joseph, but, I mean, trouble can be right around the corner, and we don't know it. Like, we just don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. And it's just amazing. I came across something. Let me just read it. You may have heard this before, but it is some of it's kind of corny, but a couple of them are pretty good. It's here, 10 ways you can tell that it's going to be a rotten day. Number one, you start brushing your teeth with muscle relaxant cream. That's a problem. And you see the 60-minute news team in your office. Or you realize that your hair, the hairspray you just used was really your new can of hair removal spray. You turn on the news and they're showing emergency routes out of the city. Your car horn goes off accidentally. And this must be dated because it says your car horn goes off accidentally and remain stuck as you follow a group of Hell's Angels on the freeway. They're not even around anymore, are they? Or are they? I don't know. Your boss tells you not to bother to take off your coat. Yeah, you're going to have a bad day. Your income tax refund check bounces. You get passed on your morning jog by a little old lady with the cane. You look down to see that you have one black shoe and one brown shoe on. Make sure. I think I've done that before. And you remember seeing the other pair just like it in your closet. So you could add to that list. Sometimes you just know you're going to have a bad day. You think Joseph realizes he's going to have a bad day? About the time they stripped him of his coat and threw him in that pit, things weren't going very good. But here's the thing with Joseph. How did he respond to this overall situation? Because, again, his life, he had it pretty easy. And we shouldn't be upset with people. You know, I don't know why it is that we get mad. People get mad at others if their life is well. You know, some people don't like the rich. You know why? Because they're rich. No other reason. Don't like the rich. Why in the world would you be upset with someone for being rich? You think they should not be rich? What's wrong with that? I mean, some people are born into riches. Is that their fault? Of course not. Joseph had it pretty, and here's the problem with his brothers. It wasn't his fault that he was his father's favorite. Like, if they were going to hate somebody, who should it have been? I mean, I'm not supporting them hating anybody, but it should have been Jacob. Why are they so mad at Joseph? I mean, that was Jacob's doing. But I'm just saying, in all of that, Joseph had it pretty good. His life was pretty good. And as of late, he doesn't even have to go and pasture the flock anymore, doesn't seem. And just like that, in the blink of an eye, his life changes completely. Now he's a stranger. He's away from home. He never could have imagined on the morning of that day he was thrown in the pit that he wouldn't see his father for another 20 years, 20 plus years. And life can happen like that. But again, the whole question is, how do you respond? And when we look at Joseph, one of the most magnificent things about him is, I mean, there's not a hint of him ever coming close to blaming God, losing his faith, even being filled with hostility of any kind. Like, he handled his trials perfectly, at least so far as the biblical account is concerned. Everything we know, and it's obvious the way he dealt with others that he never, in fact, as we read this, look quickly before the bell rings. Go to chapter 39, and it says, and now Joseph has been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, had bought him from the Ishmaelites, who had brought him down there. Now look at verse 2. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. Now, that becomes a theme throughout the rest of the narrative. Right there at verse 2. The Lord was with Joseph. I mean, that's said several times. The Lord was with Joseph. In every situation he finds himself in, the Lord is with Joseph. Why was the Lord always with Joseph? What does that tell you that didn't happen? Huh? Right. He was abiding with the Lord. He didn't lose his faith. God doesn't tolerate sin, and God would not have been with him if somehow he had lost his faith. But he never did. He never wavered. He didn't blame God. You see all kind of reactions when things go wrong, even for Christians. Many people have left the faith when something devastating has happened to them. Many people blame God when things go bad. Or just develop just an overall bad attitude, always in a bad mood. And you don't see that with Joseph at all. You could tell by the different narratives. He's a very likable guy. He gains the favor of almost everyone he's around. And so that's how you handle problems in life. Because we may never be thrown into a pit and ambushed by our brothers or anything like that, but we're all going to have problems. And how are we going to handle them? There's no greater example than Joseph. Outside of Christ himself, I mean, he handles it wonderfully. And as a result, he's blessed. And he's blessed to the point where people can see it. And that's why he's elevated. He ends up going from a pit to a prison to a palace, all because he never wavered. He never wavered. And we need to be a lot like him. Yeah, go ahead, Matt. Right. That's right. But it's always us doing the walking. God never walks away from us. We always walk away from Him. He'll be faithful to us as long as we're faithful. But He can have no fellowship with us if we're in sin and we forsake Him and lose our faith. That's against His nature. God is light, and Him is no darkness at all. So all we need to know about Joseph is right here. The Lord was with him, and we know how he responded to this devastating situation, separated from his family and now a slave in Egypt. But again, because the Lord was with him, it said he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master, and his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hand. And you wonder here, the only way that Potiphar would connect any of this with the Lord is how? Huh? Through Joseph. Through Joseph. And you got to keep in mind, everything that Joseph does with the people he's now dealing with, whether it's Potiphar or whether it's the Pharaoh's servants that he'll end up in prison with, and even Pharaoh himself, these are all heathens who do not serve God and who in fact believe in a plurality of other gods. And Joseph is very bold at whenever he's talking to any of them, that God is doing this, or God, he emphasizes to them, it's the God. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, but that's a part of him, not forsaking God. No matter where he is, who he's around, God's first. And that was Joseph. And we should again take note of that. So we'll pick up on this, him being successful and in all of that here on next week.